Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Tell the Others, my little podcast where I talk to people about experiences that have changed their life, valuable lessons they've learned, just all of those things across their life that they think, oh, this is important. I need to tell the others. And I'm joined today by Kevin Berthia, and I've only just met Kevin, but I met him through a podcast guest I had on a few weeks ago by the name of Kevin Briggs. And when I spoke to Kevin Briggs, so the other Kevin, he said, I asked him, was there anyone else who he thought had stories to tell the others? And he said, 100%, you got to talk to Kevin Berthia. So here I am today with the other Kevin, and we're going to have a chat to him and see what he has to share with us, because I think it's a lot that you will find valuable and will change the way you view a lot of things. So, Kevin, welcome. Nice to see you. Nice to meet you.
Man, appreciate it. Thank you for the opportunity and just the opportunity to speak and the opportunity to platform. I'm grateful for the opportunity. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you here, and I really appreciate, especially given the context and the content of what the stuff we're going to talk about. I know it's not always easy for some of us to go to the vulnerable place of talking about some of our darkest days, but I really appreciate you being just open and willing, because I think, like you had said right before we started recording, that it's sharing our story that is helpful to other people. So thank you for being willing to do that.
Absolutely. More and more I share my story, I'm learning that people can relate to pieces of it. Some piece of their lives is relatable to some piece of my life, and it gives them that extra glimpse of hope to understand that they can get through the darkest times, just like I did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So where do you want to start? Because there's a lot of stuff to get into. I don't know where, I mean, because I know you do public speaking and stuff like that. I saw your TED Talk.
I normally start in the beginning, where I kind of really... the beginning, where I kind of knew, okay, I had a problem. And I always say, well, age 5, because I mean, I always go back to that age 5, because I remember playing soccer, and it was always by under 6, under 8, under 10. So it always went by even numbers. So I could always remember age 5 being on a soccer team, and I could feel my brain, certain things were changing about me. And I really didn't know what it was. I mean, you're a child, you don't know.
Yeah.
How you feeling inside? You just know. I kind of shied away from mirrors. I never really liked looking at myself in the mirror. It was just little things like that. My mom told me early in life that I was adopted. I knew early in life. She told me early, like as early as age 5, I knew that I was adopted. So that pretty much put in my head that somebody gave birth to me and just gave me up. So it was hard for me to kind of understand that growing up. You know, as a kid, I mean, I was a sharp kid. Like, I paid attention to a lot of things.
Totally.
So I had a real issue with not looking like anybody or and wondering where I come from, wondering who I belong to. And you know, looking at, you know, playing sports, you watch a lot of families, you watch a lot of, you know, interaction with families. And I used to look at my teammates and my classmates and look at how their mom and dad come pick them up. And they all looked alike. They all looked like, you know, their loved ones. And you know, I was lucky enough to get adopted into an African American family, so it was not like, you know, nobody knew, but I knew. I knew that I didn't look like anybody, so it was just hard to kind of understand why. But on the flip side of that, it was a great family, so I always, you know, never wanted to make it feel like anybody feel like I was unappreciative. So I kept those emotions on the inside. I mean, we had a fairly good family dynamic. My mom, my dad, my two older sisters. I had a guy sister that always stayed with us, and an aunt that never left. So I always was around 6 women growing up. So I mean, we had a house full of love, I always say, growing up. So it was just, and that helped me. That sustained me. I grew up, you know, from pretty much from the ages of 5 to about 12, I was a routine kid. My mom and dad had me in a lot of sports. Mm-hmm. That was my coping mechanism. I was always busy. I played like 5 different sports. It was always a practice. It was always something going on. So I never really had time to really identify what was really wrong with me. I knew I had a problem. I knew I had voices in my head. I knew I had all these different things going on with me, but I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what I identified. Sports and that routine kept me busy.
But don't you think too, as a kid, like only being 5, and being little and knowing, like, that's so much to hold as a child, like, to know I'm adopted and to know, like, the logistics of that, that, okay, so someone had me, then gave me to someone else, like, how, like, you know, you can just see, I have two kids that are 4 and 6, and I'm thinking about how they would process that, and just, it would be so confusing. But then to go, but I'm in a really loving home, so I am loved, I do have value, but wait, and like, you would just have these two really competing kind of voices in your head.
But see, that's how it's been my whole life. It's always, if I'm split down the middle, half of me, yeah, it's a competition. It's, I should be grateful, but I'm kind of frustrated. I should be happy, but I'm kind of mad. It's just those emotions are always flip-flopping, interchangeable.
But then also the guilt, yeah? Like, then there's the guilt of, like, So I'm adopted into this beautiful family. I feel guilty that I'm, like, wondering about this family. And then I reckon a lot of shame that comes with that, too. And I'm sure we'll get into shame because there's so much shame down the track, but the shame that then comes in that. So it's almost like, do you feel like there was like a blanket of shame that was kind of around you from when you were little?
Absolutely. I mean, I've felt alone for so many years and was around a family, was around love. I just felt alone. I felt it was just like, you know, but for me it was hard because I knew I wasn't the only kid in the world adopted. And see, my adoptive mom always told me, compare your problems to that of the world. So, you know, for me, it was just like, well, Kevin, I mean, you know, there's other kids in the world that's adopted. You should be, you gotta just, I mean, come on. Like, you should be kind of, I've never, even to this day, cannot understand why I can't, I just can't get over, I just can't understand it, get over it, accept it. And then that's the process of it. And even now, thinking back at, you know, I'm almost 38 and I still can't process it. I was a kid then. So I can only imagine the emotions that come with it.
Well, I always say people I've worked with, clients I've worked with before that are adopted, one of the things that we've talked about is just that it's this really inherent trauma that takes place from, you know, birth or whenever the decision was made, that the trauma happens. And my favorite definition of trauma, like, yes, trauma is when your life is threatened or, you know, a car accident or an assault or something like that. But what I think is the better definition is Peter Levine, one of the gurus in trauma work, his definition is trauma is any experience where you feel profoundly helpless or lose your ability to cope. And that's exactly, like, adoption is completely helpless. Like, the child has no decision, has no choice in the matter. It's just, it's done. And this is what's happening. And so to have that thrust upon you from, you know, tiny is just, it's like you come out of the gate. It's like you're born into helplessness. And I just am helpless and I'm stuck and I don't have any say and nobody cares. The people who love me the most, you know, nobody cares what I want. And I just can't even fathom the legacy, I guess, is sort of what you're saying, is like, it's a legacy that it's a pain that kind of stays with you, like all traumas, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So where are we in the timeline? So
like I said, moving up from 5 to 12, that was my structured life. But you know, sports, it was a structured life. It was getting up in the morning, getting dressed, go to school. You know, I had practice after school. I had practice after that practice, and then I had a practice. Like, I literally had 3 practices in the same day. I had games on Fridays, games on Saturdays, and church all day Sunday. So routine went on for, like, from the ages of 5 to 12. So it was like, that was my routine every single day. It would never fail. It was never different. You throw in family vacations in that, different family events. I mean, you know, it was just like, so I had a pretty balanced life. So for me, the inside battle, I always felt like, well, you know, I can't never let the inside win because I have this so much great things. I got this family. I got so many great things. I'm looking at the chaos in the world. Like, I've always been a kid that looked at, I've watched and watched homeless people and watched people in messed up situations. So I'm looking I'm very empathetic of the world. So I'm looking at the chaos in the world, looking at my life and say, well, I'm all right. Like, you know, even though no matter how I feel on the inside, and that's pretty much how I live. And everything pretty much kind of shifted the shift happened about 1994, 95. And that was going from elementary school to junior high. Mm-hmm. And that's why I always tell people, you know, watch that shift when kids shift from schools, yeah, because I had a big shift. Now, my elementary was in the Oakland Hills. And, you know, it was, you know, we ran around, played tag. It wasn't too much going on, you know. But yeah, going into my new junior high school, the same year I went into my junior high school was the same year that my parents ended up splitting.
Oh, so okay.
This kind of, I didn't know I had all these different emotions and all these different things going on with me because they were hitting inside this dynamic of this family.
Yes.
And
yes,
when my parents split and would later on go on a divorce, all my stuff now was just on the table because I took it the hardest. Like, I watched how my sisters took it. I watched how my mom, and it was just like everybody kind of took, but it was just like it kind of left me alone. Mm-hmm. Like, and when my parents divorced, I felt adopted. It was the first time that I actually felt everything that I felt on the inside actually was in my face now, because it was like, well, I gotta pick a parent. I gotta, you know, well, I'm going back and forth with my sisters off, you know, different things. We argue, saw this argument. It was like I was the outcast, and that's how I felt. And psychologically, I knew I had to go with my dad. I had to make a decision, you know, at that time, because I knew he couldn't take care of himself. I knew my dad. My dad was a dad inside of the relationship, inside of the marriage. And I knew that he wasn't structured enough to take care of things outside of that. And I knew I would lose him. I mean, we had a separation time where they were separated. My dad was supposed to come get me on several occasions, and he left me in the wing. Like, he was supposed to come pick me up, didn't come. So I knew that he couldn't dad part-time. Like, he wasn't he had to be a full-time dad. Like, he couldn't be there. If he's not there, he's not going to be there. So I knew that I just had to go with my dad. But I knew what that came with, you know, my family dynamic living with my mom was, I knew I was going to eat every night. I knew I didn't have anything to worry about. Bills were going to be paid. Living with my dad, it's a little different. You know, you know, I'm from the ages of, you know, to about 12, I never get to have company. I never was able to spend a night in nobody's house. Living with my dad, I pretty much I'm living by myself because my dad's a gambler. He kind of gone all the time. So during all this transition of me transitioning these houses and going into a new school where, you know, violence and anger and all these different emotions of what I'm feeling on the inside. Now I'm at a school where now these emotions are played out in front of me. So it was just a bad situation at that time. And it was just, I got caught up in a lot of different things that I shouldn't have got caught up in because of the emotion that I was dealing with. I was all over the place when my parents divorced.
It sounds like, though, the age 12, 13, 14, that transitional period was like a perfect storm. You have this kid who's carrying a shame blanket from adoption and the complexities of that. Then you have parents separating, which is another helpless situation for children, right? They have no say in their parents separating and divorcing. Then you have the destabilizing situation of going from a mom that's, you know, routine, to a dad who's whatever. And then you have all of the, you know, and at 12, 13, 14, that's like awesome because that's what you want, is to just be able to do whatever you want, but you don't have the maturity to handle that.
Not at all.
And then you go to a school that, where was the school? What suburb was the school in?
The school was in the, see, I went to school, so I went to my elementary in the Hills. This was the junior high was in flats.
Oh,
so it
wow.
was a little different. So you got, you know, more mixture of flatland, you know, it was more kids that had the probability I probably didn't eat last night. So, you know, the elementary, I knew that everybody, 99% of the students in my elementary school probably ate the night before. This school, I know in my heart, looking back, like, kids were coming from broken homes, kids, so they acted out at school. I mean, now psychologically, I know looking back, but then I didn't know. It was just like, whoa, this is great. But now I know looking back, this is the environment. And the only reason I went there is because I wanted to play basketball, because I wanted to keep up with my coping mechanism, because my basketball coach ended up getting a job at that school. So I, instead of me going to another school, you know, I wanted to go play for him because I had got structured. And my mom only agreed because I know my mom only agrees because they split. My dad and them ended up splitting and divorced. So she saw me in the bad spot. She didn't want to take me away from the coach that I knew. So we followed him to that school, and I ended up going to that school. And that was the only reason why it happened, because she She never in a million, she regrets it to this day. She never in a million years would put me in that school situation.
But she probably thought it's one of those parenting moments, I think, where you're trying to attune to your child. You're trying to do the right thing. And sometimes we get it wrong, but it sounds like trying to, you know, oh, I'm going to put Kevin with his coach. His coach means a lot. Basketball keeps him on track. Like she was trying to do the right thing. But in actual fact, that school was, it sounds like a toxic kind of environment that you already have. I mean, dude, you have all these other things going on at the same time. And then now you're in a school that's dangerous. Like that's scary. And then you have all your emotions that it sounds like you were suppressing your whole life, just pushing them down, pushing them down. And then, when we get into stressful environments, it's like, hello, all the stuff gets to come up. Yeah. Wow. So then what happened?
So at about, So seventh grade, I was all over the place, bounced around, went from half living with my mom, half living with my dad. Eighth grade, my mom kind of got tired of me going back and forth. She saw my grades kind of going down. Things were just happening with me. So she had me come back, and I was kind of mad because I wanted to go live with my dad. I got accustomed to living with my dad at this time. Mm-hmm. So I went, moved back home with my mom, and I was just all over the place. And 14 years old was when was my first actual attempt, and it was on a, you know, I think it was about a, it was a Friday afternoon, and my uncle, my mom, you know, my mom's sister's husband, he left his family van in my mom's garage, and you know, I was there by myself. Everybody was gone. My mom was at work. Everybody was gone, and I was having a bad morning. I mean, my mornings are always bad, but I was just having, on this particular morning, I was having a horrible morning, and something just clicked in my head and said, "Go find the keys." The van's in the car. I mean, the van's in the garage. So it was like, and I didn't know, I didn't even think, I wasn't thinking about it. I wasn't even, I didn't wake up that morning and was like, oh yeah, I'm going to take this van. No, I just, it was just, it just clicked in my head. And I found the keys that my mom, she, you know, had somewhere in her room. I found them and I drove, I got in the car. I'm 14 years old. I've never drove a car in my life, but I know in my brain exactly where I'm going. Like I knew that.
Where were you going?
I was about 10 minutes away that me and my dad had always drove around this embankment coming home from soccer practice. Mm-hmm. And I always, for some reason, it always caught my eye when I was always driving with him. And I said, that's the first place I thought about because I knew that I could just drive off the cliff. Like, you know, I could just instantly and then it would just be over and I wouldn't have to answer anybody and it should be done. So I drove up there, but I didn't realize that the only time that I actually drove down there with my dad was at night. So I didn't know that it had a guardrail. So when I drove and drove up there, I thought I was just going to drive off the cliff. And, you know, I'm young. I didn't realize it. I just tried to go over the cliff and it smacked into the guardrail and it tore up the whole car. So I panicked, you know, kind of got scared. And then I didn't know what to do. So I drove back home and I told my mom that I was joyriding. And she just found out like last year that was my first attempt. I never told anybody about that. So that was after that, that's when the voices that would come maybe every other day, that's when from that day on into this current moment, the voices have not stopped.
Yeah.
It's like I entered into a new hemisphere or something. It was just like something changed that day. My first attempt, it was just like that adrenaline rush of knowing that it was about to be over and then knowing that it's not over and I'm kind of stuck. Now I feel like I'm stuck. So my whole life, I've kind of been feeling like I'm stuck. Like I'm stuck here trying to figure it out. Every single day I got to get through it, trying to figure it out. And nobody can know what's going on with me because for one, I don't understand it. Nobody's going to believe it. Growing up, I come from an African-American community. I mean, nobody ever talked about mental health. Nobody ever talked about depression. My family, which was kind of large, was kind of small niche. So I'd never seen anybody struggling. I never seen my grandfather believed in God so much. I've never seen him struggle with anything. Mm-hmm. So I always just thought it was just, I was just different. Like, you know, I never seen him. I've never seen my dad cry. I never seen men vulnerable. Mm-hmm. So it's just like, so nothing on the inside of me is going to show the world what I don't see. Totally. So, you know, it's just, I'm not going to be the only one out here, you know, especially come from this dominant community. I'm not going to do that. So I lived a lie and I continued on. You know, I got back, went on, act like everything was fine. And transitioned, got out of junior high and got into high school when pretty much everything pretty much changed. Because now in high school, junior high was more about survival and you know, being able to talk the talk and being able to, you know, we talked about people a lot. So if you can talk about people kind of quickly, it kind of kept people off of you. So I kind of mastered talking about people real fast because it kept people off of me. Mm-hmm. It kept people from identifying that I was really struggling. I was really in a dark place. But I knew that if I could fire back, that it would keep people away from how I really felt. So I went from transitioning into that to going into a high school to now it's all about how you look, your appearance, what you're wearing, what you have on. It's not more so what you say, it's how you wear everything, how you put every, what kind of shoes you have. So it's now I have to keep up with these things because, you know, if I don't, then I feel like on the inside, it would place me in a position where people can identify things in me that I didn't want people to see. So I always want to stay two steps ahead of the game.
So that sounds to me then like what you're saying is there's this inherent like fear that was just deep within you that I can't let people find out. I can't let people know how much pain I'm in, that I want to die. I can't let people find out what's really going on in here. And I guess too, when you're in an environment of survival, that's weakness, isn't it? Like, or perceived weakness. We think it's weak if we say, talk about my feelings or that I'm sad or I'm depressed or I want to die or whatever. So God forbid I, you know, tell anyone about what's going on for me. But then when you get to high school, then to have the environment where appearance now is what matters. So you're not surviving as much. You're kind of, you're all right. You know, you're on top of it, but then now appearance is everything. So then it's like, oh yeah, then my emotions got to go even deeper.
Yeah.
Push them down even further.
Cause I have to change. I have to create, because it was easier, kind of easier in junior high a little bit because I was in a bad place and everybody was in this dark. Like I felt like everybody would, cause that's why we were so aggressive towards each other. But now high school, now people are walking around happy and I'm like, I'm not there. Like I'm angry, but I can't show that because then now that points me out as being crazy or points me out as being something that I'm not. And I gotta fit in. So now I've always developed a way to be a chameleon, to be whatever people needed, to say whatever people needed. I figured out, let me just figure out what you need me to say. That way that's easier because you'll never question anything else about me if I just let you hear what you need to hear. So
And do you know where I reckon I see that a lot with clients is men. I find so many of my male clients are so good at just coming to therapy with like this, you know, things are great. Women will come in and in 2 minutes they're bawling their eyes out and saying, I'm not okay, you know. And so many dudes that I see, or like we'll be months into therapy and then some secret revelation will come out that they'll go, oh yeah, I attempted last month. I've attempted 5 times. I have a raging drug problem. I have a gambling problem. I'm having an affair. And I'm like, wow,
we have so many layers.
It's amazing.
We have so many layers.
It must be exhausting, dude.
Absolutely exhausting.
as a female, but like also I'm very empathetic. I'm very connected to my feelings.
No, it is.
I'm a therapist, but like for dudes, I'm just like, even when I see little boys, like I have 2 girls, but when I see friends that have little boys, I can almost see this like response when they hurt themselves or whatever. There's almost this like physical thing you can see of just like shut it down where there's just this. This is the only thing I can think of to describe it is like just pushing my hand down of just shutting it down and pushing emotions down. And then when I talk about this with my male adult clients, I'm like, where is this learned? And they'll say like, I don't know, like just from when I was a kid and TV and movies and my dad, I never saw him.
Everything that we identify with, everything that's on inside of us in our testosterone tells us that we have to be this way.
Yeah.
And everything about it is wrong. Totally. It's all wrong. And I think that I've been placed in a position where I can challenge it now because I've been so far on that side to where it's like, dude, no.
Yeah.
We are all tripping.
Yes.
Like, seriously. Totally. Like, because like you said, it is astronomically hard to just hold all this and to keep all these different layers, to always stay on guard, to always not know which way to it's coming from, because you don't know which way to defend it. The best, you know, the best life that I have ever lived has been because I'm free, because I don't have to, I'm not hidden behind all those different things. And it's just like, if I'm going to cry today, I'm just going to cry.
Yeah, totally. And that's just totally. It's just happening. It is just happening. Yeah, totally. And vulnerability, I think it's so funny, isn't it? Because whenever you talk about vulnerability, I think the common misconception is it's weakness. Yeah. And I'm not going to be vulnerable because I'm a dude. And I'm badass, and I don't feel feelings, and I don't, you know, I used to work in prison, and when I, in my early 20s, and when I was in prison, the number one thing that I remember hearing, like, if I had a statement that went with my time in prison, it was, I don't give a F, I don't give a fuck, like, that's what I heard constantly from every dude in there, because it was male prison, every dude in there, even the girls, when I would do, go down to juvenile hall or be in the hall, girls, same. Everyone just had this persona that I don't care. You don't bother me. Nothing bothers me. And it's, oh my God, it would just be like, you cannot be kidding. Like, you just got your ass kicked, or you just got, you know, 3 months added to your sentence. Don't tell me you don't care. Everything bothers you. But the vulnerability thing, I can't show it, because if I show vulnerability, I'm weak, or that's the perception. But then when you taste vulnerability and you start doing it, like you've just said, that's when you're like, oh my God, this is so much better because I'm free. Totally.
It is life changing.
So sell that, because I reckon we have dudes listening that are like,
oh, yeah.
I don't know. Explain that.
Talk that I talk at, I definitely make sure, and I always make a point to talk to the men and tell them that my greatest, everything that I have in my life and everything that I've gotten, everything has came from this vulnerable place. It is, it has not come from being this tough guy, this macho man that can take on, because we can't take on all this. We cannot. It's impossible. Mm-hmm. We can't. I'm telling you right now, I'm strong. Talking to a man that went to the Brit, like, I have 22 failed suicide attempts. Like, I feel like I'm strong, but even as strong as I am, I get tired. Mm-hmm. In those moments of tiredness, that's where your strength is not as strong as you. That's where you you don't feel the same, and you don't you lose it, and you can't have those moments. And that's why, you know, you don't know when those moments are gonna come. You know, it's so hard being strong 24/7, 365. Nobody can do that.
Totally. So you just said 22. I didn't realize there was 22.
So here I am. So at 14 was my first one. Jeez. So 15 is where I kind of started. I was just all over the place. 15, I went back and forth between mom and dad's house again. And finally my mom, I went to my mom at like 15 and a half. And I was just like, I need something. I always said it was something on the inside of me. I just need to fill this void. I don't know what it is, but I need something. And she knew it. I was all over the place. By this time, I was punching holes in walls. And I mean, I was just all over the place, just rage and things. I never knew I was an angry person. I never even knew I had rage, but I was just so angry that I couldn't control another situation, that my parents were divorced and I couldn't control that. Like, everything was changing about my life again, and I can't control it. Yeah. And I went to her and I said, well, do you think that is possible, if any kind of way? I don't know what we were thinking. I just said, do you think that we can reach out and see if I can find my biological mother? And she kind of looked at me and was just like, I don't know, maybe we can. And I think, I know my mom, she only did this because of the bad place I was in. And once again, she thought it would help. Now, you see all the stuff I had going on. Now, see, you... When I speak, you know, in front of people, they really don't understand. That's why I always say, you see all the things I had going on, but you, being a doctor, can understand all the things I had going on, and you throw in the emotional, just whatever that's going to come with meeting my biological mom. I never prepared. I mean, I thought about her every single day. Mm. I always thought about what she looked like. I always thought about, I always said, I know her voice. If I ever saw her, I would know what she always told myself. But actually seeing her, being around her, I thought it was just going to be this answer to every one of my problems. She was going to come in my life. I was probably just going to go live with her. Yeah. I don't know. I just had it all in my brain.
Which is so common, dude. Like any client I've ever worked with that's adopted has had that same fantasy, that same, or even kids who say their biological mom left when they were two or three and they lived with their dad and biological mom was sort of in their life, but kind of absent. Everyone has this fantasy that when mom or dad return, we're going to like have this, you know, magical moment and we're just going to like be besties. And there's this whole sort of like rescue fantasy that they're going to rescue me from my situation. But then also what was so hard for you is also for people listening to know what was happening for you developmentally. So adolescence is all around identity. And adolescence is all around figuring out who am I, where am I, where do I come from, what religion do I want to be. Adolescence is all about pulling away from mom and dad and figuring out who I am, who I want to be. So that already is why adolescence is often so hard, right, for so many families, because this whole pull-push thing and kids and I hate you and but I love you, but, you know, blah. So you have all that going on. But then you have, when you're adopted, your identity is already massively confusing because I don't know where I fit and who wants me and who am I and all of that. So then to add your mom, oh my Lord, to meet your mom in the mix. Oh my gosh. So what happened?
And I never was, like I said, I never was prepared. When I met my mom, see, I had a clear cut in my brain. I said, okay, my mom who adopted me loves me so much. Yeah. And for some reason on the inside of me, this is what I told myself. I always said, if she has to, she loves me this much, the woman that birthed me, she has to love me more. Like, I don't know why I said that.
I think
I just needed her to. I needed something. At the time, I needed something for me. Like, I needed somebody for me. I needed somebody to just, something that was just for me. Not for nobody else, that wasn't attached to anybody. I needed something for me. When I met her, it was, when I met my mom, now that I look back, my mom was 34 years old. She was in and out of psychiatric hospital. She was on and off of medication. She was in a horrible relationship with a married man that she was the significant side girlfriend. I mean, she was in a horrible place in her life. And what I needed her to be, she, in a million years, if you would have paid her all the money in the world, she couldn't be what I needed her to be. Totally. And I still didn't get it.
Yeah.
And I remember the first night staying with her. My mom, you know, she came into my life and we talked for a little while. And I remember like the first week that I met her that weekend, I wanted to spend the night. And my mom was like, this is kind of fast, Kevin.
Yeah.
You know, but I was like, no, I have to spend it. Like,
she's the one. Yeah, she's in my life. Amazing.
Like, what do you mean? I waited 16 years. So, you know, like, you know, how, you know, I'm not going to wait in line. Like, and, totally. You know, and just the whole time I stayed in Oakland, California, my mom born and raised in Richmond, California, which is 15, 20 minutes away.
Yeah.
My whole life. Like, you know, she's been, you know, so that was like,
how did that hit you? Because I would be sort of thinking like, why didn't you come to my soccer games?
Like, part of me was like, well, dang, you never tried to reach out. Like, cause I don't, you know, when you're young, you don't understand the system. You don't understand what I know at 38, I didn't know at 16. I didn't know that she didn't know no information. She didn't know. Yeah. My thing was, I was 20 minutes away this whole time and you didn't even try that once. And then when I came into her life, like I say, my first night that I was there, I just knew that my first night it was going to be a certain way. And it wasn't. Like, I literally stayed on the couch. She was in her room. You know, she was going through whatever she was going through and she cried all night. And I just felt alone again. Like, it was just like another critical moment in my life where I feel alone again. Like, I was banking on this my whole life, and now I feel alone again with the one person I wanted to be with my whole life. And it was just like,
and who you thought,
relationship never, you know, it just, and you know, it was tough for me because I was willing, I was still in high school. So I was literally getting up early in the morning to get on BART just to go to high school. My high school is like 5 minutes away from my house. Like, you know, it's a 10-minute bus ride, but living with her, I had to get up 2.5-3 hours earlier to actually, in order to stay with her, to get to school. But I was making that sacrifice because I wanted to stay with her. Like, totally. You know, 11th grade come around, 12th, and then into my 12th grade year, you know, I kind of was, now I'm bouncing between three homes. I'm bouncing between my mom's house in Richmond, I'm bouncing between my dad's house, and I'm bouncing between my house in Oakland. So that's where my bouncing around started. And it's just like, it started me on a catapult of having clothes at different places and never really having anything of my own. Like, I never really had a room now. Like, now I'm just kind of like, you know, floating around and kind of living everywhere and just kind of like, you know,
couch surfing.
At the same time, going through high school, you know, I've kind of figured out, you know, they had assembly. I remember my 11th grade year, and they was just asking people like, what are you going to do with your life? And I didn't know. So I was kind of scared to graduate. So by 11th grade year, I was trying to like flunk out of school. Like, literally, I stopped going to class. I stopped doing things. I stopped, you know, I was literally trying to flunk because I was trying to like, so I passed 11th grade, got to 12th grade. Now I'm really scared because I don't want to graduate because I don't want to become an adult. Like, I'm literally like my third, fourth, and fifth period classes. I'm think back now, like, I don't know how I'd have a diploma, but somehow they graduated me my 12th grade year. And it was just, you know, now, you know, I'm kind of out into the world and I didn't know what to do. Like, I'm, you know, trying to figure out what I want to do with my life. The only thing that helped me was I had a soccer coach. I played soccer and I was a decent athlete. I mean, but I wasn't playing sports to go professionally anywhere. You know, I had talent agents and all these different people, scouts, you know, coming to see me, but I didn't care about basketball like that. I didn't care about baseball. I didn't care about soccer. I played because it was something that kept me busy enough to I didn't have to think about how I felt about myself. See, I struggled outside of the field, outside of the court, identifying who I am, but on the court, football field, whatever it was, I knew exactly what I needed to do. So yeah, I was great because I knew my position. I knew what I had to do. I knew what I meant. I brought value to my position and to that team, and they appreciated it. So that's why sports wasn't never for, you know, trying to, you know, come up in life. It was just like the camaraderie of being around. It was just like,
it's where your one big appeal. Exactly. It's where your identity was. Yeah. I have identity in sport. I have identity on the court. I have identity in the position I play. I bring value. I have worth. I'm important. I matter. I'm enough. Yeah. And nowhere else in your life were you getting that message. No one else was communicating that to you through their words or their actions. I mean, I think your adopted parents did, like, they loved you and stuff like that.
They did. I know they did.
Yeah. But it wasn't, but it, does, I think it wasn't that, like enough. I said,
the divorce, rock them, you know. Looking back, it rocked all of us, but I didn't know that. I just looked at as the feeling of how I felt, you know. I felt alone in that. Like, even to this day, like, it still has rocked us as a unit, as you know, my older sisters. We're not as close as we were, and I look at pictures of us when we were kids. We were rocked and shattered by this time. And you know, by the time I got out to college, and you know, this school that wanted to come get me, that was San Francisco. It was San Francisco City College. Now I haven't, you know, coming from Oakland, you know, I pretty much stayed in Oakland. You know, we didn't really travel that much unless I was traveling with my family somewhere. So I never really went to San Francisco, you know, to just go out there. So I really didn't know too much about it. So when his coach was like, come to San Francisco, I was like, I mean, I didn't really know, but I didn't have another plan. I didn't have anything else. So he, you know, he invited me out. He showed me to school. Everything looked cool. I was like, you know, okay, I guess, you know, at the time they were, you know, ranked in the nation nationally, but see, none of this stuff mattered to me, you know? So it was just, you know, I was just like, okay, the opportunity to just play, like, you know, okay. So I got out there and things started flourishing for me. I mean, I was got in class and I kind of got away from everything. And I wasn't able to play five or six sports. I had to figure out something that was going to cope, you know, that was going to keep me busy enough. And I realized when people get older, they get jobs. That's the next step of how to keep yourself busy. And I didn't realize that. I was like, wait, how am I going to, you know, compensate, you know, only sleep 2-3 hours a day. How am I going to compensate for the other 21 hours? Like, you know, I can get a job, work 10 hours, go to school, work, you know, that's another 8 hours, practice. So now I got a plan. So I got a job working at UPS. And that job was in San Bruno, which is an hour away from my school, which put me 2 hours away from home, 2.5 hours away, almost 3 hours away from home, like as far as transit. transit wise, because I had to catch the BART and bus. Because now at this mm-hmm. time, when I graduated, I elected and went to go live with my mom my first year of college. So while I was going to school in San Francisco, I was living in Richmond. So every day I was commuting on the BART and bus and, you know, walking up from the BART station. So I did that my whole freshman year of college. Trying to build a relationship with my mom.
Can I ask, what was that like for your adopted mom? Because I'm thinking, if I was your adopted mom, I would find that tricky. I would find that hard. If my little boy that I had raised said, I want to go live with my biological mom, I don't know. I feel like that might hurt a bit, or that would just be tricky. I think that'd just be tricky. What was that like for you guys? How did you navigate that?
My mom, adopted mom, Narvella, she's never made me feel any kind of way. Like, she's always been support. Like, my whole life,
that's awesome.
She has been supportive.
That's awesome.
Of my venture for me trying to find my family. She has not even for a millisecond. And I'm trying to think in my heart of hearts.
Yeah.
She's never made me feel like a certain. She's always, if anything, she's encouraged it. Because, I mean, she knew that pieces of me needed it. Like, it was just, she couldn't do nothing about it. She knew I was going to do it anyway. When I found my mom in my life, I remember the conversation when I found her. Like, she could see it in my heart. Like, I wasn't letting this go. This could have been the worst thing in the world for me, but I wasn't letting it go because it was like, it was like my mom, you know. And with my mom, you know, eventually, a couple years after meeting my mom, I was able to meet my dad.
But
that was the same situation as meeting my mom. So it was this high expectation, but meeting my dad was a little different because meeting my mom, it was like, I was like not really feeling like a, like I didn't have like this kid type of feeling when I met my dad, I felt like I was 2 years old, like I was putty in this man's hand and I couldn't understand it. And it was just like, I didn't like the feeling. It was just like, I just wanted to be around him. I just wanted to be next to him. Like, you know, and my mom, I wanted to be just have her in my life, but it wasn't the initial, when I first met her, it was not like when I first met my dad, not at all. Not even, it was not even by far. It was just something about him, you know, it was just like, you know,
I'm getting that image in my head of like a puppy with the daddy dog of just sort of like looking up constantly and just like,
and it was just like, I couldn't. Well, when I first met my dad, it was for the first time in my life I had something that I looked at that I felt like looked like me.
Wow.
It was for the first time. It was like I looked, because I just saw myself. I saw pieces of me. Like, it was just like certain things about me that were on the inside that nobody knew about. Having a 15-minute conversation with him solidified everything that I felt. It was just like, oh, that's why I'm the way I am. Like, It was just totally different.
Did you not feel alone then? Was that the first time you didn't feel alone with him?
I didn't. It was the first time I didn't feel like meeting my dad was actually psychologically, now that I think about it, that was the first time that I didn't feel alone. It was like the first time I felt like I belonged to somebody. And
wow,
that was short lived. I met my dad going through the whole transitional period of going into college. I met my dad and he was in my life and he was quickly out of my life. And I just found out, you know, when I was just Googling his story, that on my birthday, actually, I was supposed to spend time with my dad. He was supposed to spend time with me. He was supposed to come pick me up and, you know, we were supposed to go have a good time. And I didn't hear from him at all. And like, he just vanished. And I never really talked to anybody or told anybody how crushed I was, but that was the change in me. It was like I was completely done. Like, that was the hopelessness, and I was pretty much done at that point. Like, because I didn't have no way of contacting him. It was another situation where I had no control over. And it was the promises. It was the, you my baby. It was we're going to do this. We're going to do all these different things. And I believed it. Like, if, for the first time in my life, I believe with someone. Like, my adoptive dad, Charles, could tell me 100,000 things, and I never believed it. It was no expectation. And if he did it, he did it. If he didn't, he did it.
Yeah.
For the first time in my life, I believed somebody. Like, it was only two people in life that I actually believed. My grandfather who was my adoptive mom's dad and my father. I believed what he said. I believed all these different things, and then psychologically, not having him, and ironically, this is how it played out. Mm. He got me a rental car for my birthday. Mm. And it was, you know, I got me a nice little Jeep rental car, and I was supposed to be driving that car. I was in a relationship at the time. I got into college, and I got into a relationship. That was probably pretty much one of the worst things I could have did at the time. I got into a relationship with an individual. Mm. Now, she ran track, and my dad rented me a car so I can go to one of her track meets, which was in L.A. Mm-hmm. Now, the night before I was supposed to leave, I was driving around with friends. Of course, I got a new rental car. I'm picking up my friends, driving around. And, you know, we stay out to about, you know, 2-3 in the morning, wee hours of the night. And I drop my last friend off. Yeah. And when I drop him off, it was like a cloud of depression hit me, and I felt alone. It was like I was so high all night. We was on this fun. We was having so much fun, and then I dropped him off, and in a millisecond, as soon as he went inside, I drove off, and I don't know. It was just like I felt alone, and then the voices started talking, and then all these different things. That night, I tried to take my life. Mm. I was going down the street, and I put my foot on the gas, and I let my hand off the steering wheel. And I remember it. My family thought that I fell asleep at the wheel. Mm. And they just now finding that was an attempt. Mm-hmm. And I end up totaling out 4 cars.
Dude.
I remember bashing my head. And I remember when I woke, when I came to, I was alive. And I couldn't believe I was alive. Like, cause I had took my seatbelt off and everything. So I couldn't believe I was alive. And I ended up walking away from the scene. And I walked away from the scene. And I remember my mom picking me up, and I went home. And I remember going to sleep for about a week. I remember not going to the hospital or anything like that. And
wow.
I remember my dad was supposed to come pick me up because it was for my birthday. And I never talked to him. It's like he disappeared. I got into this accident. Everybody thought it was an accident. I had took my own life. I thought he was mad that the rental car was tore up. He never wanted to talk to me again. Or he knew that I had took my, I don't know. I had all these different things that was going on with me. I just know he had disappeared.
Yeah. But the way that you processed that was that I must have done something to make him leave.
I must have done something.
Yeah.
And then during that time, that was pretty much where I was just, I kind of spiraled after that. That was pretty much like, you know, that's when, you know, we went from arguing every other day in my relationship to arguing every day. Certain different things were just all over the place. I had another hospitalization where I grabbed the knife for the first time. And this was my first time that now my family's involved. My sister was at the house at the time, and I get involved with an argument going back and forth, and I grab a knife and I run out the house. Now the Oakland Police Department have to come out, and they go back and forth with me for about 10-15 minutes, and I have this knife to my throat. But for some reason, I can't let the knife go, because for the first time in my life, I'm finally in control. I'm finally being able to dictate a situation, and nobody can control what's going on, and nobody gets it. But for me, it's like a power surge, and I'm not letting this knife go. So they end up tasing me, and I end up going to George Psychiatric Hospital. Now, this is the first time that I didn't even know psychiatric hospitals even existed, because like I said, I'm from Oakland, California. So I've never even heard mental health. I've never heard depression. I've never heard 5150. All I know is I wake up handcuffed to a bed with people screaming, and I don't know what's going on. Nobody explains anything to me. You know, people are coming in and I'm yelling at them to get out, and they, you know, turn around and get out.
And how old are you? How old are you at this point?
At this time, I am 19.
Oh my God, you're a baby.
So this is my first hospitalization, first thing I'm seeing everything going on. And they're telling me all these different things, and I'm telling them to get out. I didn't know I got to comply with these people. They're not telling me where I'm at, that I'm at a site. That finally, they start telling me all these different things, and they start running all these different, trying to run these different tests. They gave me the PQ-9 test. They gave me all these different, tell me about I got depression, all these other different things. And, you know, I just tell them, you know, I just had a bad day. Like, I don't believe none of these different things. Mm. What do I need to do to comply to get out of this place? So finally, I end up just doing enough to get out of that place. And I said, I just got to get home. So I did enough to get home, got home, and I just was trying to go on with my life. But my adoptive mom, she, you know, couldn't handle it. You know, she loves me. And she had the one of the hardest times dealing with the fact that I had to go to this psychiatric hospital. And I was just telling her, like, Mom, I was just having a bad day. Like, it's not a big deal. Like, but for her, I promised her I would go to outpatient, some follow-up, because that's what they recommended, because I wasn't going to go. So I went to Kaiser Permanente, you know, California, outpatient. And they immediately, here's the problem what they did. They immediately put me in an outpatient program and put me in a group. I'm 19 years old, and they put me in a group full of adults who are comfortably used to talking about their problems. I have never talked about a problem in my whole entire life. They thought I was going to be comfortable talking about, and I got a lot of problems. They don't have no idea the type of problems. I'm coming with 19 years of just pain,
trauma,
and suffering, trauma, of wanting to die, of so many different things. And I can't just spill all out to strangers. So they put me with a clinician and a therapist who prescribed me some medication. I end up staying in this program. It was supposed to only be for like, I don't know, 8 weeks. I end up staying there like maybe 17 weeks, probably way too long. In that time frame, they gave me 6 different therapists who prescribed me 6 different medications. Every single therapist made me feel like the same way. Like, I should be over my childhood issues. Like, why am I still tripping off being adopted? Like, you should be able to move. You're never going to be able to move forward in your life. I mean, every single one. I had a male therapist that was white. Well, I felt like, okay, well, maybe I need a woman. Then I got a woman. Mm. Same thing. Then I said, well, maybe I need a black therapist. So I got a black therapist. Man, that was horrible. Then I said, okay, well, I'm going to go back to a woman, black therapist. Same thing. So then, you know what? I'm just going to, whatever they give me. And it was just the last two was just even worse. Like, it was just everyone made me feel exactly the same. In that time frame, keep in mind, I only had 2 attempts up to this point. Like, you know, in that time frame of going back and forth from medications, in that time frame, I found myself looking up, you know, how to drown myself, how to do food poisoning, basically I was looking up ways to kill myself. I needed 100 different ways to figure out how to get myself out of this pain, because I was tired of taking medication. I was tired of talking about my problems. I'm going back and forth. I'm wondering what happened to my dad. I'm trying to figure out why my relationship with my biological mom is not working. I'm trying to figure out why I can't seem to cope with the divorce. I can't seem to cope with the adoptions. I can't seem to figure out my life. My relationship problems are all over the place. Like, all these different things are going on with me. Like, and I'm just all over the place. So, you know, I end up having another, I think, 9 attempts in that time frame. Just in a small time frame, which is, you know, now I'm cutting myself. I'm just things that I'm just not even, I didn't even know I would even get to this place. I'm here now. I'm in probably the darkest place I've ever been in my life. And I just got to figure out, and I can't talk to nobody. Nobody knows these things. These attempts are not where people know. They know about when I held a knife to me, but they don't know about any of the other stuff. They don't know that, you know, this is my everyday thing. I got to wake up every day and feel like a burden trying to figure out how am I going to get myself out of pain. Every single day, this stuff is getting overwhelming. But I got to a point where I was tired enough to, I told my mom, all right, I'm weaning myself off medication. I don't know if that was probably one of the worst decisions, but I was just like, this is not working for me. I'm not going to counseling no more. I'm not going to therapy. I had dropped out of school. Like, all I was doing was like literally going to therapy every day. I wasn't working. I couldn't work. I couldn't do any of those things. So I said, I got to go back to school. I just got to get my busy life back. At least when I was doing my busy life, I wasn't attempting. Like, you know, I had 2 and, you know, 19 years as opposed to, you know, 9 in a year and a half. Like, that's the numbers for me. I'm like, I just got to go back to my busy life. So I begged my soccer coach, went back to San Francisco, and I said, you know, can I please get back on the team? Got back on the team, got back working at another job, and just got back busy. Like, I just acted like, you would think that, you know, somebody go through all these different attempts and all these different things. How do they just go through life? I don't know. I just figured out how to just erase it all and act like it didn't exist, because I didn't want to deal with it. I literally am the king of just, you know what, forget it. I'm going to bury it and just bury it until where, you know, I have to feel it, because my burying is, I still feel it. I just don't have to deal with it. So I feel this emotionally pain every single day of my life. I just don't want to deal with it. So I'd rather figure out a way to deal with the pain than to figure out a way to deal with dealing with the pain. I don't know if that makes sense. I don't, but that's totally.
But I think, But I think that's what everyone does. I think everyone pushes it down, and then you get to, as long as you can. And I think you get to a point where it's like all of that shit that you're pushing down starts to smell. Yeah. And it starts to impact and starts to like ooze out, and it starts to impact all these other areas of your life. And you get to a point where you're like, I actually can't do this anymore. And then that's where I think we turn, we shift, we turn, you know, left instead of right. And we do this alternate path because it gets too much. And yeah. Everyone has that tipping point, and everyone has that point. And I think what's amazing in your story is that, I mean, that you're still here is just mind boggling, but Mike, does that just not tell you that there was more for you to do? Obviously, like, wow.
I had to be, I mean, because that's just right there. I mean, you know, I finally got, mm-hmm. like I said, I got back into school, got back on the road of what I felt like success. And, you know, here I go again, another decision time. And I made a decision, you know, somebody I knew from my past, I came back into my life, and, you know, we started hanging out, and, you know, she ended up pregnant. Mm. Now, another emotional mind frame that I have to deal with, being a father. Now, I never in a million years, you know, you see people have kids all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, but I don't know psychologically that how much it's going to affect me, you know, because I have this emotional tie to my biological father, because I have this emotional tie to my adoptive father, because of the divorce, because of all these different things. I didn't know that psychologically I was creating a monster on the inside of me that if I ever did have kids, Kevin, you would have to be prepared. But I had a kid at the most unprepared time probably of my life psychologically.
Totally.
You know,
and it was another helplessness. It was another helplessness to add to all of your other helplessness experiences.
I definitely didn't need to add
you
this.
You got another one. Wow.
And she was supposed to be born, and I never forget it, she was supposed to be born June 23rd because I'm exactly 9 months. My dad told me the story. My mom and dad, you know, did their thing on her birthday, which is December 23rd. I'm born September 23rd. Okay. Now, you know, of course, whatever I did on my birthday, she was supposed to be June 23rd. Yeah. So, you know, she was supposed to be exactly 9 months. So I'm banking she came April 6th.
Whoa.
Which is a significant, and you know, they don't tell you why. So once again, I'm in a situation and they don't prepare you, because my whole thing was I thought I was getting there and the baby's gonna come out. You know, how you see on TV where they wipe the baby off and hang you the baby. And the parents look with this amazement, like they just gave birth to the greatest thing that ever happened. I was banking on that moment, but it's a little different. And they don't
kind of
prep you for that. Seeing her, you know, being as big as my hand, all the different tubes, psychologically, that was the done part of me. Like, I think that was, and I always say, if you want to know where I died, I didn't die in the divorce. I didn't die in the adoption. I didn't die in all I died watching her struggle, and I didn't know why. Because I didn't have the type of job at the time. I worked at the post office, so I didn't have the type of job where I could call them up and say, hey, I just had a premature baby. I need to stay by her bedside for the next, you know, 4 to 6 weeks because, you know, that's just what it is. I was a casual. I wasn't a full-time employee. They wanted me to be back tomorrow. So I died knowing that I had to leave her every single day in the care of somebody else if she was going to be all right, if she was going to be alive when I came back. All these different things were going on with me. So in the 6 weeks that she was here, every piece of me was dying in that 6 week. And I never, I mean, you don't prepare, as a parent, you don't, you don't know, you know, like I think about like, even as a parent now, like how do you prepare to be as a parent and watch a child like struggle? Like she goes through hernia surgery, all these different surgeries. And they're not telling you why. It's just so naturally like the divorce, naturally like the adoption. Naturally, like everything else in my life, I blame myself because there is no other answer.
Wow.
I've never been given an answer for why anything in my life. So the easiest, not the easiest, so the only thing that my brain always does is pinpoint and say it's you. So the battle for me has always been you. It's always me. It's always not me against the world. No, the world can't stop me. It's me against me.
Yeah.
So in that time frame, losing that identity and understanding of trying to be a father, because my grandfather told me it's two things you got to protect and provide. Like, you know, I've messed up protection because she's struggling and I can't do nothing about it, you know? So I've got to keep my job. I got to go to work because I got to keep my job to be able to provide. Yeah. And, you know, 6 weeks go by, she was able to finally come home, but I'm so all over the place. I never even get the opportunity psychologically to really enjoy it. She got home, and for the first time in my life, I did get like 10 days of just where my brain didn't have to think about anything, because it was about her.
Yeah.
It wasn't about me. You know, I was staying up all night. I had diapers. I had, had, you know,
someone else to worry about.
Yeah,
rather than yourself.
It was just so much bigger than me in that moment. Mm-hmm. And that was quick lived. Like I said, I got 10 days of that. And I remember, you know, one Thursday going, maybe life can get better. Like, you know, just thinking, looking at this baby, this beautiful baby girl that finally came home, that finally I'm a part of, you know, I wasn't focused on the horrible relationship that me and her mom had. I was just finally focused on just me and her relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like, maybe life can change. And it was just like, you know, going to the mail on that same Thursday, the same Thursday where I said, maybe that life can change. I got the bill for my daughter's stay at her doctor. So, you know, and, you know, at the time I'm young, you know, 21 years old, you know, I'm thinking to myself like, okay, how much could this bill be? Like, you know, I'm thinking, okay. I mean, you don't think, you know, in my brain, I was thinking maybe $1,000, like literally, the most in my brain. Like I couldn't go past that. And for me, that was a stretch. I was getting stressed off the thousand.
Dude.
I was sitting there like, how am I going to pay it? I didn't even look at the bill yet.
I'm so afraid right now. I'm so afraid because I know the number is going to be way bigger than $1,000.
I just knew. So looking at that bill, getting to that last page,
oh. You know, you gotta
through all these different things, because they don't do this nowadays where they itemize everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And getting to that last bill, it totaled up to $250,000.
$250,000.
It was like,
dude.
Like 2, 4, seven, some change. It was just a whole lot of numbers. And immediately in that moment, I knew I had failed everything, because I've lost the protection. God. The one part I have is to provide. I'm going to work to provide. Now, there's no way I can come up with that type of money. There's nothing I can do. In October, I had put in a bid to transfer that kind of fell through. In October of 2004, I lost my job. I got $250,000 in debt. Like me and the mother of my kid, we not even speaking. So I'm not able to see her on a full-time basis. Like
dude,
I don't know where I'm at. Like, I don't know who he was that time. I look back at that time and say, I don't know who that was because I was completely given up. My New Year's resolution for 2005 was not to be alive, because I knew when Christmas came and I wasn't going to be able to see my daughter for her first Christmas, because me and her mom were back and forth, eyes in. Mm-hmm. I wasn't going to be able to see what meant the most to me, the something that I needed the most on Christmas. Mm-hmm. I was back. Actually, that same Christmas, 2004 Christmas, me and my biological mom were at it back and forth. Me and my daughter's mom were at it back and forth. Like, it was like,
oh,
I felt
my God.
Alone. I remember sleeping in my car for about 4 or 5 days. It was just me by myself. Like, I met some girl from a completely different area that nobody would know I was at. I ended up living with her, so nobody would know where I was at.
Mm.
I had canceled everything. I had turned off my phone, and I was just ready to just cancel everything. By the time 2005 came, and I got up, and I my New Year's resolution, I said, okay, I got to get myself out of pain. But I knew my mom's birthday was February 15th. So I told myself, well, I could just make it to my mom's birthday. Psychologically, I didn't want to do anything to myself before my mom's birthday, you know, have her grow up and, or, you know, have to cherish that memory before her birthday. This is just all I was thinking about. I don't know why it would matter after her birthday, but, you know, that's just what I was thinking about. So I picked my mom up, took her to dinner, and I was saying goodbye. She didn't even know I was saying goodbye. You know, I threw the phone out the window. I remember I had a prepaid phone at the time. I grabbed the prepaid phone because I had my regular phone, threw that out the window so nobody could contact me, grabbed my prepaid phone, and I was just on my way. So from February 15th until March 11, 2005, when I drove myself to the Golden Gate Bridge, I didn't eat, I didn't sleep, I didn't talk to my daughter. Anything that I was accustomed to do that was keeping me and sustaining me to live, I didn't do. So when I woke up, you figure almost – a month later on March 11, 2005, I woke up at about 4:48 a.m. and every painful moment of my life that I didn't deal with, I felt all in one morning. It was like I felt it all. I felt it was like 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. It was like a timeline of my pain, everything in my life that I didn't deal with. And that was everything, because everything in my life, I never dealt with any of it. I never for once stopped and said, this hurts me or anything. I've never in my life said, this bothers me. That hurt me. Never. So all these different emotions hurt me in one morning. I got up and I said, I can't do it. So I had to figure out a foolproof plan. And the what's ironic about my story is I've talked to a lot of parents. I've talked to a lot of people that have went to the bridge, a lot of survivors, a lot of people that have thought about going to the bridge. They've had visions. They've thought about the bridge for weeks, months, years. They've looked it up. I didn't even know anything about the Golden Gate Bridge. I didn't know where it was. I didn't even know it existed. I didn't know people were iconic for jumping off of it. Wow. In that morning, when I got up, when I pumped my gas, as the pump clicked, my brain clicked and said Golden Gate Bridge. Like that's it, just like that. I didn't think about, there wasn't this epiphany about the bridge. I thought I was going to be the first person to jump off of it.
Wow.
I didn't know. I had no idea about it.
Yeah.
So we didn't have Google Maps or anything back in the day, you know, where you can put stuff in. So I had to old fashioned ask for directions, but I was banking on, you know, hoping in the inside of me that whoever I asked for directions, they would look at me and say, you look like a young man from the Bay Area. Why don't you know what the Golden Gate Bridge is and ask me why I'm going there?
Totally. And nobody
did. I was kind of like banking on that a little bit because it was like a piece of me that still wanted to die.
Yes.
I mean, that wanted to live.
Yes. Like
it was, if 90% of me wanted to die, the 10% of me was banking on somebody to ask me, just ask me why I was going. So I asked the toll keeper at the Bay Bridge, because you got to go over the Bay Bridge in order to get to the Golden Gate Bridge. So I asked the toll keeper. She never even looked down in my car. She gave me directions and looked straight and gave me and gave me my receipt and looked straight and gave me directions. She never looked at me eye to eye.
She didn't
never,
see
not
you.
One time.
She never saw you.
So again, I felt alone. I drove in that car alone.
Yes.
Drove around, got lost. Now I feel like I can't even do anything right. I got lost in San Francisco.
Oh.
Imagine the frustration. You're just trying to drive somewhere, to jump somewhere, to end your life, and you get lost. Imagine the anxiety.
It sounds like a bad movie.
I picked the wrong city. San Francisco is not the great. That is the wrong city to try to find, navigate your way through when you don't know how to drive in it. So I finally get to the bridge, it's a park right up on the North Tower. And it's like, if you go to the bridge any day of the week, there's never a park where I park that. It was just like, it was just destined waiting for me. It was just like right there in front. I get out the car, I leave the keys in ignition because I have I'm not coming back.
Totally.
This is not for show. This is not, I'm not here. If I got to this point, I'm jumping. I'm not.
This
here.
Wasn't a cry for help. Yeah.
No. This is no.
I'm out.
Listen,
I'm done.
The cry for help.
Yeah.
It was way gone. We're done. I grabbed my phone. I got out there and I walked for about 5 minutes. And I literally, the 10% was looking for one reason.
Yes.
Not to jump. I couldn't find it. I made one phone call. They didn't answer the phone or whatever. Went back and forth with them or something happened. And I just said, all right, I found a good spot. I looked over the railing. And I saw water. But when I looked in the water for the first time in my life, when I looked in that water, I saw peace.
Mm.
It was like my brain, I knew I had to get in that water. When I looked in that water, I saw not having to be a burden. I saw not having to lie. I saw not having to figure out where I belong. Mm-hmm. I just saw, Kevin, you don't have to live that lie no more. I mean, just, I saw freedom.
Yeah.
I saw a way out that I didn't never see. Like it was just, I knew it was right there and it was nothing that was going to stop me this time. And I took a couple steps back. And as I start walking towards the railing, I built up my speed a little bit. I knew I was hoisting myself over this railing. I heard a voice, and that voice was Officer Sergeant Briggs. Now we don't know what he said, but it was enough of where it kind of distracted me and got me out of that mold where I was at. I don't know how. It was just this, it wasn't a, hey, what are you doing? It was just a compassionate sound that kind of triggered the darkness in me that made me kind of like click out of where I was at to where I'm jumping over the railing and I hear this voice. So now I grab the railing and I turn myself around and now I'm sitting on this 4-inch cord, but I put myself, now I'm upset. I'm horribly angry because I came here to get myself out of pain. I came here to jump. I didn't come here to put myself on this railing now. Mm-hmm. And now I'm in a situation. It's only two things about Kevin Berthia that I hate. I hate heights and I hate being cold. This is March in San Francisco. It's 40 degree wind chill. I'm 220 feet in the air. Like,
oh,
this
my
is
God.
This is a nightmare waiting. Like my voice keeps telling Kevin, all you have to do is just do a little nudge back.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing.
Just
like,
fall backwards. Me. Just fall
there's
backwards.
Nothing,
yeah.
That's it. There's nothing holding me. Most people, when they see me in that picture, they think my right arm is holding onto the railing. No, I'm freezing cold. It's in my hand. It's like I'm shivering.
Yeah.
Like the wind is, I'm 140 pounds on that photo. So the wind is like pressing against my back. And that's what's pretty much keeping me against the railing.
Wow.
This voice that distracted me from my destiny, because my destiny was getting in the water, I thought.
Voice
that's trying to, that distracted me, he's still trying to get my attention. So I'm like upset. I'm yelling at him, stay back. You get any closer, I jump.
Yeah.
Because that's how I felt. I kept my head down the whole time and I had my eyes closed because I'm scared of heights.
Yeah.
So I'm literally yelling at a stranger in my eyes. I never even know who I'm yelling at.
Yeah, yeah. Oh my gosh.
So this goes on for about 10 minutes where he's just trying to get close enough to hear me out or gain some type of conversation with me. And finally, it's like after 10 minutes go by, something inside me clicked and said, why do you even care?
Yeah, totally.
Because I felt alone on that bridge. I felt alone on that rail. But in like the 10th minute of him going back and forth, I didn't feel alone anymore. It's like I knew he was there. And parts of me said, why do you even care? Not to him, but on the inside of me, enough to allow him to get closer. Now, that was 10 minutes ago that went by. For the next 92 minutes, most people, when they Google my name, Kevin Berthia, and they look at that photo, they will never believe that for the next 92 minutes, I stayed in that same position on that 4-inch cord with my eyes closed.
Wow.
And 89 of those 92 minutes, I talked to my first responder, Sergeant Kevin Briggs. I never looked up. I never knew who he was, a cop, never knew anything about him, never knew his color, his race, never knew anything about him. I just knew I was telling this man my whole entire life. I started at the age of 5, and I worked myself all the way up to the current day, 22. Everything that I wanted to tell the therapist, everything I wanted to tell my biological mom, everything I wanted to tell my adoptive mom, my biological dad, my adoptive dad, my sisters, my coaches, my teammates, everything that I wanted to tell the world, I told him in 89 minutes, and he just stood there and listened. Traffic at a standstill. Like, I know, looking back, I can feel everything at a standstill. I can know it's a helicopter behind me. It's so many different things. He never rushed me. It was never, all right, you might as well. He just shut up, and he listened. Like, he literally, like, didn't talk 92 minutes. He talked 3 of the 92 minutes. With that much pressure on the line, with everything, at any millisecond, if he would have rushed, if I wouldn't have got out everything I needed to get out, I wouldn't be here today.
Mm-hmm.
To have that type of compassion, that type of patience, that type of understanding, this, it goes beyond a job. See, 92 minutes went beyond a job. That was beyond his job. That was beyond what he was required to do. That was him being a human.
Yeah.
It wasn't about his uniform. That was Kevin Briggs talking to Kevin Berthia. That wasn't Sergeant Officer First Responder Kevin Briggs talking to distressed 22-year-old broken down man over the railing. That was Kevin Briggs talking to Kevin Berthia. A conversation that changed my life, because how did I know he listened? Everybody said, well, how do you know he listened to you? Because I, truth be told, I talked about a lot of things in that 89 minutes. But it was only one thing that was going to bring me back over that railing. And it was the same thing that brought me over the railing. How I felt about being a failure as a father. He made me realize my daughter's birthday, which is April 6th. I went to the bridge March 11, 2005. He made me realize her birthday was the next month. You need to be here for her birthday. I was looking for one reason. He gave me that one reason. I put my arms up and I still had to make a decision before I put my arms up. I still had all these different emotions going on in me because I could, at any moment, I can just do a small nudge and it's over. I don't have to deal with this pain. I don't have to explain myself ever again. But it was something about wanting to see her. Wanting it not to be the end of my story like this. Put my arms up and he whisked me away. It took me to San Francisco General for an hour or 2 hours. They put me at, you know, a medical center in Fremont for about 14, 15 days. I had to recover from a lot of different things. My mom, my biological mom came in. She's the only person I allowed to come see me. It was ironic because me and her wasn't even close. But for some reason, she's the only person I wanted to come see me while I was in the hospital. And psychologically, that wasn't good for me because when she came, it just threw me over. I got home, and I never really wanted to deal with this day. I never wanted to deal with March 11, 2005. My mom, as soon as I got home, my adoptive mom, she came to me. She said, I don't lie to you. You know, I'm always honest with you. And she came and brought me the San Francisco Chronicle and showed me that this picture of me was front page of the San Francisco Chronicle. Now, I've always wanted to be front page of the paper. Like, you know, I'm a basketball player, baseball, something. Not like this, because when I looked at that picture, everything about me died. And here's why. I didn't know who I was going to be now. See, the person in that picture doesn't look like the life of the party. He doesn't look like Kevin that has all the answers. He doesn't look like Kevin that's the fun guy, that jovial. He looks like he's crazy. That's how my look on it. It's like my cover was blown.
Your secret was out.
Yeah, people that know me from the back. They know those shoes. They know that haircut. You can't see my face, but they know me. I don't know who I go back to, so I panicked. I literally panicked. My biological grandfather died pretty much 2 months after I went to the bridge.
Oh, my gosh.
So I had to be there for my biological mom. So I never had time to process the bridge. I instantly went from the bridge to not want to deal with it, like acting like it didn't exist, to instantly being there, being thrown back into a situation with my mom, because we went for a time of spell where we wasn't even talking. Now I'm forced to kind of be back into our life because my grandfather passed away. So now we're kind of like in each other's lives again. I got all these different things going on with me. Like, so from 2005 into 2013 until I met Briggs again, I pretty much lied about everything that was going on with me. I stayed in a dead-end relationship. I lied about everything else. And that's where the 22 attempts was. Because before 2005 made attempt number 12. I had 10 attempts between 2005 and 2013. So by the time I got to 2013, I was up to 22 attempts. In 2011, I went through my own personal divorce, which rocked me. 2007, my grandfather died. Like, my very meaning of life and spirituality, my connection to God, my connection to peace and happiness passed away in 2007. And I couldn't, you know, that was 2 years after I went to the bridge. I stayed away from him after the bridge because I was so ashamed to be around my family and friends that when he died, we didn't have the relationship that I wanted to have because I was hiding from everybody dealing with the bridge. So when he died, I never even got a chance to even say goodbye or tell him that he was important to me. Or how much he's important to me, something I still struggle with to this day.
Can I ask, what was the shame like? Because like when you said that, when you saw the photo on the front page of the newspaper and then it like hit you like, oh crap, my secret's out. Now everyone knows I'm not okay on the inside. I've had everyone fooled. And now everyone knows it's for sure I'm not okay. How not okay? Look at the photo. That's how I am not okay. Then what was the shame like after that? Because I can imagine that it was just like debilitating. You know,
it's my brain always said the same thing. Who drives to the bridge? I just couldn't grasp it.
Yeah.
Like I couldn't, you know, I just couldn't do like When I saw that picture, I never wanted to deal with, like, I literally only saw that picture twice. In from 2005 to 2013, I saw it twice. My time, one time when my mom showed me when I got home, and the second time, my ex used it in court. She blindsided me in court, and I had to explain, you know, I had to explain because I was hiding from it. She brought it to court. Oh, I didn't even know about it. Now I'm sitting in front of the judge and three other people, and I have to explain this picture of me on the bridge. Like, yeah, I look great. Like, yeah, really? I look, you know, I look like a, and she's telling, you know, the judge and all these people that I would hurt my kids and all these different things. Psychologically, I was just all over the place. Like, it was just, I still didn't want to deal with it. I still didn't accept it. And literally, it took me, you know, you would think 22 attempts, and by 2013, I went through a divorce, my own divorce. Like I said, my grandfather died. All these different things had happened. By 2013, I was right where I was in 2005 with a New Year's resolution to kill myself.
Totally.
So it was like I was right back. It was like I was right back there. Only thing in 2013, the only thing that helped Sergeant Briggs, who you got to interview, AFSP, which is American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, they honor somebody every single year with a Lifesavers Award. And they have this gala in New York, and they honor, you know, a first responder or, you know, whoever, whatever they want to honor. That year in particular, in 2013, they wanted to honor Officer Sergeant Briggs for his work at the Golden Gate Bridge. Now, they wanted somebody that he had particularly helped or somebody he influenced to kind of present him the award. And he, you know, it's hard getting, you know, somebody who he helped. But he had kept a letter. My mom wrote him a letter in 2005 thanking him for being, you know, being Kevin's guardian. Now, he held on to that letter. All these years, he held on to that letter. And so he reached out. He told the AFSP to reach out to my mom and ask my mom if she would come out to New York and present the award. Now, my mom, who, you know, had a stroke or whatever, wasn't in a position where she can fly or anything like that. So she convinced me without telling me why I was going to New York, because she knew that I would never get on a plane and fly to New York and talk about and meet Officer Sergeant Briggs. First of all, I didn't even know he was I didn't know this man was a cop. I didn't know who he was. I didn't know he was white. I didn't know anything about this man. In that picture, my head stayed down. My eyes were closed. Yeah. I knew nothing about this man. I never talked. I didn't even know his name until that, you know, that, until I got to New York. I still didn't know why I was there. So, but my mom, she knows who I am, how I am. I don't, never ask questions. That's just who I am.
Yeah.
When you wanted to do this podcast, did I ask any questions? I just said, sure, why not? Let's roll with it. I don't care. Cause that's just who I am. I don't, I don't mind. Like, you know, I go with the flow. So she was just banking on me going with the flow. They put me in this, you know, $300 tuxedo. I've never been to New York. So, you know, I was just like, well, okay, I'll just go. So I'll get to New York. They have, you know, I get out there and they got the limo waiting for me with my sign. That was like next level. They put me in this fancy hotel. I get into the hotel room. You can't even see the bedroom when you walk in the hotel. It's like this huge room. So I'm thinking, you know, I made it. Like my mom made it. So I get in there and I remember it was a message on the phone, and it was from the, and it was a red blinking light. They said, you have a message from the radio station. And I said, well, I got to tell the radio station I'm not my mom. And maybe they found out, but you know, joke's on them. So I called the radio station back and they say, well, yeah, Kevin Berthia. And I'm like, okay, I don't even know how to know my name, but I'm just going with it. They said, well, yeah, we just want to interview you. Want to know if you want to, we can interview you live on the air about your 8-year reunion with your first responder. And I'm like, 8-year reunion with my first responder? Let me call you right back. Hold on 1 second. Let me call you right back. So I get off the phone. I call my mom. Say, mom, what are they talking about? She said, well, I know you wouldn't have went if I told you what you was going for, but you're there and you're going to meet Briggs.
My God.
She explained who Officer Briggs was. He's my first responder who was in that picture with me. And I said, oh, mom. Nothing I can do. Now I'm stuck in a situation. So I called the radio station back. They start talking about that day, March 11, 2005. They don't know that it's the first time I've ever talked about the day. I've never talked about this day, never. Not to therapists, not to anybody. You know, you think somebody go to the bridge, they need therapy, they need counseling. I never talked to
anybody.
Not you. I literally lived a lie. From 2005 to 2013, I never uttered the day March 11, 2005. Never. I never even dealt with it. I thought about it, because you can't help but think about it or feel it, but I never talked about it. So I get on live on the air.
That's why, because he said, sorry to interrupt you. He said to me, and that award ceremony was his second chance at life. And I was like, I didn't ask him then because I was like, I don't get it. Because wait, the attempt was so many years before. Why, you know? Yeah, and he said it was a profound moment.
From 05 to 2013, I was living in that dark, like literally. Now, I wasn't in and out of that dark place. I had bought real estate. Like I was like live like I had got a
you
job.
You were the mayor. You were the mayor.
Like, I was the mayor of the dark place. Like I was sitting in there chill. Like
yeah,
I set up shop and I was there until I came out of that. Got to New York. And I got when I got on the phone with that radio station, it was like, I can't explain. It's like as the words were coming out, that the load was getting wasn't so heavy anymore. It was like, oh man, it was like I felt lighter.
Totally.
By the time I got to the Columbus Circle and it's just this magnificent place where they was having this event. You get in there and they're having this cocktail hour. I'm all dressed up and I'm in there with all these fancy people and they all dressed up and doctors and lawyers and all these rich people. And I get in there and I meet him for the first time and I don't know what to expect. I don't know how this guy is going to be. You know, I don't know. Technically he did save my life. I don't know what type of person he was. As soon as I shook his hand, I knew immediately that it had to be him and why it was him. It was just like, I knew it. Cause as soon as I shook his hand, it was just like two ice cool boy buddies that haven't seen each other in a long time.
Yeah.
It was like, it didn't feel weird. It didn't feel awkward. I mean, I never even knew who this man was. And here I am standing in front of him. And it was just like, wow. And he got on stage. And I remember when we got in there, he got on stage and the Yahoo documentary went up and I'm facing the crowd. And the crowd is, you know, I'm facing the crowd and the crowd's looking at this big jumbotron behind me. And the picture goes up and everybody goes like that. And I remember for the first time, I turn around and I look at it. And this is the third time I looked at this picture of me on the bridge. And for the first time in my life, I accepted it right before I went on stage on the inside of me. I accepted that it was me in that picture.
Wow.
That changed. Just looking at it on the inside of me, I said, that's me. Yeah. I got on stage and I talked openly about everything that led me up until that day, March 11, 2005. And it was a level of vulnerability that I've never felt in my whole entire life. It was like everything that I hid for, every emotion that I wanted to run from, it was on full display. Mm. It was just like anything that I want. It was there. I couldn't get away from it. I couldn't run from it.
Mm.
And after I spoke, I came down and I was just on this, I can't even imagine this, the same high that I used to be on when I was running and trying to be away from my problems. I was on a different, I was like 10 times higher than that.
Yeah,
it was like I couldn't explain it. It was just like, whoa, I didn't even know this feeling. And I came down and I remember it was a line starting to form and I get down to my table. And I remember it was this lady in line, the first lady in line. And I came down after speaking. Now, I've never spoken openly about anything my whole life. I never, you know, talked openly. You could put me in front of people and crack jokes all day, but this is something serious. And I came down and this lady, she was just extremely emotional and I couldn't even really look at her because I'm a very empathetic person. And I can hear her talk. She said that my son Jacob, he lost his battle 5 years ago. Jacob lost his battle 5 years ago. She said, now look at me, because I couldn't look at her. She said, look me in my eyes. She said, Jacob lost his battle 5 years ago and I haven't slept in 5 years. She said, tonight when I go to my hotel room, I'm going to sleep. And it's because of your stories, because you told your story and now I can better understand what Jacob was going through. Now, in that millisecond of a moment, everything about me and my life changed.
Totally.
Because in that moment, two things happened. I didn't feel alone. I knew I wasn't alone. I didn't feel alone. And I realized that it was so much bigger than me. So much bigger. And then I had to make a decision on my life. That was literally 7 years ago. I had to make a decision because I was still living a lie. I always call him the New York Kevin. New York Kevin was vulnerable. He was out there on display. You know, here I am crying, emotional, whatever you needed. That's just who he was. But the California Kevin was ready to die. California Kevin has exalted all resources of trying to figure out how to cope with moving forward in his life. But I just found this new sudden brisk of life. I gotta fly back to California with the mother of my child, who I shouldn't be with in the first place, because she's one of my biggest triggers, even though she was in New York. When I was in New York on that stage talking about my horrible day, she was at my table. She was there. Like one of my biggest triggers was there. The dynamic of knowing I had to fly back and I had to figure out my life. I flew back and it was May 9th when I flew back and I had to figure out, you know, I never called out of work. I called off work that, that Friday, didn't go to work. And I called a friend and we had a picnic. And I sat down at water, in front of water, and we talked about different things. And I told my friend in that conversation that I wanted to make a decision for my life and I didn't know how. Like, I knew that that because I was big on, once you put yourself out there, you got to be who you are. I'm big on that about who I am, about people. Like, and I, that's why I've never put myself out there, because I knew I wasn't ready to live up to the standards of, if you put yourself out there, you got to live up to it. You can't be, you know, trying to help people come out of a dark place living in it, Kevin. That's, you cannot be that way. You cannot be living in that dark place, pulling people out, living there. Because then that doesn't, that defeats the purpose. And I said, I got to figure it out. It took me about 2 weeks, but on May 21st, my anniversary is coming up, May 21st, 2013, was the first day I woke up and I didn't want to die.
Wow. I'm writing that
and down. I've been keeping track ever since.
May 21st,
2013. That was the first day.
Wow.
That was literally the first day. Now, and look at the, and you see, I had, let me see. Where is it at? Hold on. Let me see. Where is it?
Wow.
Oh, here. And see, I created this. I don't know if you can see this.
Yeah, I can.
Okay. Wow. This, if you can see, that says May 21st and it says my life.
Yeah.
That's where it started. And I came up with this. So ever since that day, I've marked every day on a calendar to mark my journey, and I just get a planner, and this is what, this is my life.
Oh my God.
Every day I just, because before that, you see, this is what I was living, an empty life. So that was literally 2,600. Now I'm at 2,659 days ago. So it's just, every day is just, you know, I've been able to travel. I mean, it started from that day. And I came back and I wanted to take control of my life. And I had to, I knew I had to get, or I had to get rid of a lot of things. And this this wasn't easy. Ladies and gentlemen that's learning this, please tell me, this was not easy. I knew I had to get rid of the relationship that I was in that was tied to, you know, we were married. I had to, you know, but divorced, but still kind of going back and forth for the kids. I had to make a decision that I couldn't be in this toxic relationship anymore. One of the hardest things, because when my parents divorced, I already told myself, I'm never going to be away from my kids. I'm never going to have them feel like I felt. Like, never. So I stayed in a horrible situation because of that for so long. But I knew that once I stepped out, I had to do certain things and sacrifice certain things in order to get to where, you know, I needed to be to fulfill my purpose. Now I found my purpose. I knew that this story, the things that I've been through in my life, were preparing me for who I am.
It wasn't
that life was picking on me, that being adopted was a why me. It was a why me because I have to be the representation of certain things so that I can help people get through them. And it took me a long time to realize that. It took me a long time to get out of me, because it was so many different things that were happening. I mean, even to this day, I mean, still things that happen every single day. I'm just so many different things that I have to struggle with. Since that time that I left in 2013, I've seen my kids probably three times because of situational things of how their mom feel, or certain things of how they feel. Because now I've moved, I've changed my life, remarried, have another child, another family. They feel isolated. They feel like, you know, however they feel, which is granted because they get information. So it's just all these different things. But I found a way to cope with these things. So it's not like, I don't want people to think that, you know, oh, my life was just got so much better. And just, I'm still got, I still got so many different things that can take me out at any moment. I just had to get to the point where I won't allow these things to take me out, because I have so much more things to live for. And we all do. Like, it's not just my life that's just, and I always tell people, it's all of our lives. It's not just, it's just not the things that I didn't went through. It's what we all go through. Like, it's not about me. And that's why I always try to make people understand, like, yeah, I've been through a lot of stuff, but it's so many similar stories to me, to mine. I mean, I've been on this journey in mental health since 2013, and I've heard so many stories.
Yeah.
Like, you get to travel, and I've been able to travel out the country. I've been to what, almost 40 something states over the last couple. Like, I've been so many different places. I've talked to the Army, the military, the Navy, like first responders, doctors, lawyers, policemen, you know, kids, high schoolers, colleges. I mean, I've talked to every walk of life of people.
Yeah.
It's the same thing, that this doesn't have a color. This doesn't have a favorite race that it wants to attack, you know, just like the Corona COVID-19 everywhere. And I keep trying to tell people, and I always say that because, you know, we talk about the numbers and suicide has the same numbers. And I keep trying to tell people, if we get on the same alarming rate as COVID-19, we will change the complexion of how the world looks.
Totally.
Completely.
Totally.
So that's just, you know, my life, it in a nutshell, as quick as I can.
Wow. What do you think? I mean, so a couple of things. That the awards ceremony, one thing I picked up on that you said when you looked at the picture for the third time in your life and you looked at the picture and you acknowledged, that's me. I thought that was such an interesting choice of words that your brain picked there, because, you know, so much of your story up until that point was about identity and who am I, and where do I fit, and who loves me, and where do I have worth, and where, what's my purpose, and who am I? And then it's like in that moment, your brain went, chick, click.
Yeah.
That's me.
Yeah.
And then to have that beautiful, like, click supported by that mom, who then basically gives you purpose in a box. She just goes like, here you go. You've been looking for this. I've got it. Gives you purpose.
Yeah.
I mean, to have those two moments meet in one, you know, under one roof, like, no wonder that was then a catalyst to then shift you into this totally different trajectory.
That was it. Without either one of those, it has to have both.
Yeah.
You gotta have both, because who I am, I need to see it. I gotta feel it. I gotta know it. Mm-hmm. That's just who I am. I have to know it. It has to be validated.
Mm.
Like, I finally accepted the picture, but to know that I can make, because everything about my makeup is always has been wanting to make an impact on the world.
Mm.
Like, everything on the inside of me, I cringe at when I see people and they're in a struggling place. I've been praying for people even beyond, because I never want them to be in the dark place that I've been, not knowing that everybody has their dark. I didn't even realize people have their own dark place. My whole life I've been praying for people. I've been helping people. I've been not knowing that they're living in their own dark place, trying to keep them away from the dark place, not knowing that they're in it.
Dude, I totally hear you on that. That's so one of my biggest things, like, that I'm so passionate about. And I think it must come, I guess, from having been in that place and having been in darkness with my own depression and wanting to die in my early 20s, and feeling that's such a big, like, I'm with you, like, passion for my life is knowing that suffering and knowing that darkness. That's probably, you know, a huge part of why I became a therapist, is because I don't want people to suffer. You sit here kind of going, when you hear people share their stories of pain, you sit here on the other side going, it doesn't have to be like that. It doesn't, like, I know a way out. And you're almost like, sometimes I almost feel panicked with people where I want to just convey it to them so intensely, like, it doesn't have to be like this. I know it feels like it, and you feel like this is permanent, but this is temporary, and I promise, I know where the door is. We can get out of here. You know, there's just this passion, and I think that's why a lot of us go into mental health or public speaking or suicide prevention, because when you know that kind of darkness, I think it just becomes all of our mantra to just, we need to get everyone else out so that no one else has to sit in this pain. And to think of how many people we lose to that darkness. Yeah. And there was a prevention option.
Yeah. Yeah. And because of knowing who I am and knowing how I operate and knowing over the last years how I've been able to be in front of people's lives. And I have this ability in my heart where I feel like, all I need to do is just talk to you. Like, I can reach you if I just have 5 seconds to get to, just give me a little time to listen, talk to you. Just just let me pour something in you. And if I think if I had that that time with, I can't have that time with every individual on the face of this planet. I know, but if just theoretically, if I could, and I think that's what, because I know that the people that I have been able to reach out to and the success, we're like, we're batting a million here. Like, you know, it's just the opportunity to just really just allow people to just give them a different mind frame, a different mindset where they say, well, how did you go from this place to this place? A lot of it started with how I go to sleep and how I wake up. Like, when
say
I
more
change
about
that.
Say more about that.
When I, okay, I want you to go to bed with all the world's troubles, not knowing that the next day is going to bring more world's troubles. So Monday, I used to try to go to sleep Monday with Friday, Saturday, and Sunday's troubles, not knowing that Tuesdays is going to overwhelm. And you can't do that.
Yeah.
Like, you can't, you have to go to bed with a, try to go to bed with a clear mind, because you go to bed with a clear mind, you wake up. I used to wake up, and every single day I used to wake up, I said the F word. No lie. Because I was upset that I had to get through, I had to figure out a way to be the whoever anybody needed.
I'm still here. Damn it.
Because my prayer for a lot of years was just, because before I started attempting was, God, just take me. Like, just, I don't even have to wake up. It's just so simple. Just so every morning I used to wake up, it's like, oh, you don't hear me. No, you don't.
What?
Come on. So it's just different now. It's just so different now.
So how do we box this up for people to make it bite size of what? Okay. So if we have, I have a lot of people who will be listening, clients of mine, especially clients who are in the dark place right now, who I will be telling to listen to this. So what do we want to say to them? What, these are the, this is what, you know, changed Kevin's life. This is what, so, okay, going to bed, but I know what they'll say. How do I do
acceptance,
that? You know,
that's a word. Acceptance is a word that just, once you accept certain things in your life and you don't try to understand them and you just accept it. See, it's certain things in my life that there is no explanation for them.
Yeah.
And I've lived for decades trying to figure out why and have missed out on life trying to figure out something that doesn't have an explanation. And we do this as people. We spend time on things that just can't be explained.
Yes.
We are not in control of anything. We are not in control of absolutely anything. I think that that's one of the hardest things I had to understand. And once I understood that, it helped me. Like, we don't control what family we came to. We didn't know what our birthday was going to be, what color we was going to be. We didn't know our race, the hospital. We still don't know nothing. We only can predict the first couple of seconds. And then, because we know exactly what are we really in control of? And I was like, well, we're only in control of our response, how I respond to what I'm not in control of. If I can figure out how to control the response, like, I know I can't control that. It's a lot of different things that we go through in our life that are just not our fault. But how we responded to them to make us feel like it's our fault. Like, the divorce wasn't my fault. Being adopted was not my fault. But for somehow, I took on the whole capacity. Now I have to reprogram my brain to understand that it wasn't my fault that she made a decision, Kevin, because she was young. She couldn't do it. She just couldn't do it. Your dad wasn't around. She couldn't do it. She didn't have the stability. She didn't have the support. That's not your fault. You didn't come into the world and she didn't look at you and say, you know what? No, you're not good enough.
Yeah.
That's not how it happened. Yeah. So when I now have to train my brain for so many years, because I told my brain that she looked at me and said I wasn't good enough. So now I gotta reprogram, and that's what we do. We tell ourselves things are just aren't true. So the
stories.
Acceptance of things, literally accept things for how they are. Like, this is where I'm at in my life, and you can start your day one. I tell people, your day one can start right now.
Yeah.
Like, I went my whole life, 30 something years, living in a dark place, and I woke up and I said, okay, May 21st, 2013 is gonna be my day, and I haven't looked back since.
Yeah.
It's just that it's just all about really, really being tired. Like, okay, I'm enough. This is my life and it's worth living.
Yes.
It's not meant for me to be upset, tired, and just unhappy every moment of my life. It's not. Like, and it's not. And it's not. And I just wish I could just, I wish I could put every broken person in a room. Like, I wish it was a room big enough. Like, and just put them in a room and just tell them, a room full of mirrors. So they can really look at themselves and see the value. Like, people are so valuable. Like, and I just think that they don't realize that. And I think that we can make them realize that if you can really, really start really seeing the value in you. Not what you can do for people, but what you can do for you. You're valuable to you. And that value makes the world valuable. Like, and I just think that if we can just get to that place, you know, if we can just get to that place. And I'm not going to stop. You know, I'm going to do everything possible. You know, I put 30 years into this living the wrong way, living in a dark place. Walking by people that I saw in a dark place that I probably could have encouraged. So now I'm going to spend 30 plus picking up people no matter where they at. And encouraging them and telling them that, they have hope. That even in the darkest times that they're in their lives, like, I'm your light and you are your own light. Like, whatever I got to do, like, I'm in this. And I'm like committed and anchored to it.
So, I hear you that once you get out, you want to tell everyone, because I always say, like, you know, like, dude, I'm nothing special. Like, I wasn't equipped to deal with what I went through. I didn't have any special skills or background or training or anything like that. Like, that was pre-therapy, like pre lots of stuff. So for me to get through it, I'm like, dude, it is totally possible for you and you and you and you and you, because so many people out there are nothing special and have no training and no background in this. And so it's like, anyone can get through it. Anyone can recover. Anyone can find peace. Anyone can find wellness. Like, suffering isn't the only option. And I think when you're in that hole and you're in that dark place, it feels like I'm surrounded by suffering and I'm surrounded by pain. And the only way to turn the pain off is to die. That's it. And so I always try to get clients to see, I always try to say, do you want the pain to stop or do you want to die? Because
what
most
keeps you in that dark place?
Exactly.
Because a lot of people don't realize, a lot of people go into the dark place and don't even know what's keeping you there. Like, what's because you're supposed to walk through. Like, you know, you see the light at the end of the tunnel. You're supposed to walk towards the light. What keeps you
in
from not walking through? What keeps you in that dark? You got to really, that's where I tell people the acceptance cards for really accepting who you are. You got to learn you. Learn your trick. You got to learn you. You have to really learn you. And why are you in this dark? Why? Why are you in this tunnel, Kevin? Like, my biggest root is my adoption. Everything clings
back to that,
to the adoption.
And you, this, sorry to interrupt, the story that comes with it. That's what it always is. It's the stupid stories. There's an incident, a stimulus, a trigger, a thing that happens. And then we take from that this story that we make up that comes from maybe one comment or a couple comments that someone said or whatever.
That's all it
but
takes.
But it's a story.
That's all it takes.
That's all and it then, takes. Yeah, we take it as truth. And it's like we input it into the computer. And then it's like, everything after that, the computer says, like, this means I have no value. I'm alone. I have no worth. And it's just like, that's the path until you have a moment where you go, that's actually just a story.
That's it. This brain to tell you things, your brain to tell you things, like, and that's what people don't realize. People don't understand how powerful the brain is. Like, it's what drives everything. Like, you don't realize, you know, you got to really study your brain and realize. I had to really, like, dissect who Kevin Berthia is to understand how to cope with certain things in order to move forward. Because I'm not going to try to build who I am and build myself to be a, you know, suicide prevention advocate, and then I fall off, you know, and I got all these, you know, however many, right now I got hundreds of people, but one day I want to have millions of people following me and understanding my life or whatever it may be to give them encouragement. And then I fall off. And then now I got million people looking at me, because that's the hardest thing. But suicide prevention advocates, we go through the most things, but I had to figure out how to combat it, how to really, really deal with it, you know, really, really identify certain things. And that's what really just keeping things in front of me. When I feel a certain way, I'm just going to feel it. I'm not going to act like it doesn't exist. No, whatever it feels
in that moment. Yes, totally.
I don't care.
Yes.
And the more I learn to do that, the easier things have gotten.
100%.
It's certain days that I'm just going to cry. Like I said, I'm just going to cry.
I'm going to cry
that.
Yeah.
I'm emotionally, I'm tore up on the inside, and there's no point in me trying to act like everything is fine with me. I'm not fine.
Yeah.
Eventually, I'll be all right. I mean, I'm not, you know, suicidal, but I have to allow these emotions, deal with these emotions before I become suicidal, because not dealing with the emotions is going to make me, on top of dealing with, it's too much. I'm just going to deal with this wave of emotion, because this too shall pass. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be here forever. Mm-hmm. And it's just in that moment that people get critical in those moments. They lose it in those moments. It's like the stages of those moments. And if they can just get past that one moment and get to the other side, it's not even small. It's a lot of times, it's like a small little nudge to get you to that next moment. Mm-hmm. But this is just the pain in that moment. It's going to feel unsurmountable because the breakthrough is coming.
Yes.
You know, and like preparation, like, it's not punishment. None of this is punishment for our lives. Everything in your life is preparing you. Even the things that you, the decisions that you make in your life, they just prepared you. The decisions that the decisions in your life that probably wasn't your fault and you just had to deal with them, they're preparing you. Mm-hmm. Like everything, if you look for everything as preparation instead of punishment, like I had to, once I started getting that and triggering my brain, like, okay, this is preparation. This is preparation. The most horrible thing in my life, if you can take the bridge and now that's a sign of hope, there's nothing. Listen.
I can't, and
that's what makes me feel like I need to run around the world.
Yeah.
Like I need to run. Like I can't talk about this enough. I can't say this enough. I can't. That's why I say I need a room that the world can sit in. I want to talk to the world.
Yes.
Like that's what Kevin Berthia wants. And I'm very, very comfortable. I want to talk to the world. I want to talk to every broken person that doesn't feel valued, that's in dead in relationship, that is searching for something outside of themselves. I want you to tell you that it's inside of you already. Like everything I needed was already inside of me.
Yes.
I didn't have to go find me. I was already there.
Yes.
I just had to stop being everything else that I wasn't.
Yes.
I am a very empathetic person. I am a very caring person. Like I see people and they struggle and I do cry.
Mm-hmm.
And I allow myself to feel that now, because for a lot of time in my life I didn't feel it. I didn't want to feel it. I always felt like it's a curse. Like I have this gift of empathy. Like I'm probably the most empathetic person in the world. Like I can feel the world's pain. So I always say, well, how can I don't want to feel the world's pain. I got my own pain to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
But then I had to realize, once I realized that in New York, that it was beyond my pain. Now I can just feel the world's pain and understand that I'm here to navigate, to make sure people are not in these dark places and that they see hope and that they always understand that they are important. Like, you're important. If you're listening to this and you didn't feel important this morning, just know you're important to me. Like, I literally get up in the morning and I pray for every individual. I look at the world population and get a number and however many people, and that's how many people I pray for. I don't care about who's saying it doesn't need. I pray for everybody because we all need it. We all need to get out of the places that we're in. Even the people that think they're in the happiest place ever, that are hiding from the dark place, we all have a dark place. Every individual on the face of this planet. So don't think that people that are living these greatest lives, everybody has a dark place.
Yes.
And what people need to realize is that part dark place is the same dark place for the homeless. It's the same dark place for the poor. Mm-hmm. Dark place is the dark place. That's why you see people with millions of dollars take their own lives.
Yeah.
And you wonder why. Because it's not about the money. It's about the dark place.
Yeah.
It's not about not being able to get out of that dark place.
Yeah.
And I just know my life is my purpose is to get people. Like, if I got to literally stand at a gate to get people from going into the dark place, I'll stand there on guard.
Totally.
And you're not going in there. I've been in there, lived in there, and I got the key. And you're going to have to do a lot. Because I didn't, you know. 22 suicides in, I think I'm equipped, okay? I feel like ain't too much you can do to me, like, that I haven't done to myself, and you not get this key. And that's just, that's how I live my life.
Wow. Isn't it amazing? Like, looking back and, like, you know,
I know you tell your story a lot, but I think every time, and same for me, whenever I kind of tell my story and go through from beginning to present day, and it all kind of comes up and you go through all the memories and stuff, like, isn't it just amazing? Like, it's just...
When I tell my story, I'm listening to myself.
Yeah.
Not in a arrogant way, in a more of a can't believe. Like I said, I'm 7 years into this. Like, when you live the life that I've lived, and that's why I say one day when I'll be able to come out with a book and really just put everything in there, when you can really, like, literally see everything from five that I haven't had a break. Mm. Like, even to current day, like, I'm still dealing with so many different things in my life. I have so many different things that can take me out, that can take me from this place that I've created for myself. But that's where... You know, I won't allow, like, you know, it's like a, I don't know, not like a gang, but it's just like, I just, now that
not
I'm in
today.
It, I'm in it.
Yeah, it's not today. Gonna, it's not going to happen. Today.
Like, I've seen it. I've been there, and I won't let it, like, change. I have so many different things waiting for me. Like, I have my whole life waiting for me. Like, I have so many different places I want to go and so many different languages I want to learn to really just, so my combat my story to different nationalities and different languages, because it's not about... just saying it to people that can understand it. Me, it's about saying it to the world so you can just translate on a whole nother level. So I got so many things I'm trying to do. Like, it's just, you know,
it's my heart's amazing. So big. It's so amazing because you look at where you were in those darkest years and you couldn't write, you know, one thing you were looking forward to, one thing you wanted to do, one thing good about yourself, one thing good about other people. There was just no goodness. And that's what I think is so hard when you're depressed and in that state, is it's like nothing you see is good. Nothing you see is okay. Everything's bad. Everyone hates me. I'm alone. It's just everything is negative. And then it's just so mind-boggling, really, to look at, you know, I'm a therapist. Hilarious. Like, would never have thought, you know, in my early 20s going through that I would be ending up here. Yeah. You know, advocating for suicide prevention and talking to people and talking them down and talking them off the ledge and being in that. Like, I never would have thought that I would get to that point. You never would have thought that one of your worst moments is now, you know, one of your talking points that you probably have on the slide behind you when you present. Like,
I never in a million, crazy. I mean, when I say that picture is worldwide, I never in a million gazillion, like, that's why I say I will never, what keeps me humble is I will always live in disbelief because it's a billion other stories in the world. It's a billion other people that would have loved to be in that picture, like, and just deal with the whole fame or whatever that comes with. And it's just me. I just, like, I'm blown away. I never can, you know, like I say, 7 years later, I just think about it and it's just like, because I still wasn't accepting it and still how that all came in. Now I'm a suicide prevention advocate. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, my Facebook, I have, first thing I put is suicide survivor. Like, who would have thought, like, I would even be saying and just comfortably walking around telling people that I'm a suicide survivor and, like, really, like, I'm the bridge guy. Like, Kevin, you're the bridge guy. Like, like,
it's just such a great, it's such a great, like, reminder.
Yeah, it's like, but it reminds me that it's okay to be vulnerable. It's okay to not be okay. It's okay. All these different things. When I see that photo now, it's just like, that photo has been everywhere. And that photo was everywhere so people can see that. I honestly, in my heart, felt like I went to the bridge for people because I don't know why I picked the bridge. I felt like I went there as a symbol, and that's what I got. Because I still, to this day, I still can't understand it. So, only thing I look at it and say, well, you know, I went for everybody already. I always tell people, I went to the bridge already for you. Like, you don't have to go. You don't have to do that now. Like, I did that for you. Like, I did that for all of us, in a sense. So that now we can all get our stuff together so we don't have to do it. Like, let me save that. Let me tell you how it was so that you can save you so that you don't have to encounter this pain, this painful moment, because y'all don't want nobody ever to ever be in that moment, ever. Like, and if you in that moment, if you was in that moment last night, if you dealing with certain things, it's somebody reading right now on this podcast probably has a note that's already written a note. I mean, I've talked to people all the time that just cut the last night. And those are the people that I want to reach. I love talking to people that you know, I need to talk to the broken people. I need to talk to the people right now in this moment that they don't have any hope. That's who my heart is for. Like, and that's where my calling is for, you know, the people that don't, that think that people have forgot about them. I have not forgot about you. I haven't. The world may have, but I'm not part of the world. I've always felt like I was different, and I am, because I'm not part of the world. I'm praying for you. I'm encouraging you, because I know that anybody's one moment can change, right? Just like mine's. Like, 100%. I woke up literally and didn't want to die. Like, you don't go for 30 plus years wanting to die, and then one day you wake up not wanting to die, and then you don't realize it can. If it happened for me, like, I'm nobody. Like you said, I'm nobody important. Like, I'm nobody special.
Yeah,
and I'm the most, to me in my heart, I'm the most undeserving person of it. So for to still, that's what keeps me humble. To do everything, 22 attempts in, all these different things, to take my life away, and now I spread hope and give people hope about wanting to live. It's just, it blows me. I mean, just, amazing. You know.
It's amazing. It's so amazing. And it's such a privilege, isn't it? I always say that, like,
it is.
Doing this work as a therapist, like, if clients ever say, like, thank you, I'm always like, you don't need to say thank you.
I can never do what you do for me. I tell, like, even for you right now, like, I can, what you've given me, like, I haven't, because I don't get with this, you know, just COVID. A lot of my stuff is I can't speak. So a lot of my stuff, like, you know, 9-10 of my events have been canceled. So you've given me an opportunity to share my story, and I'm able to, you know, open up again, and things what I need to do, because it's been days since I've been able to open up and share my story. Because for me, I'll share my story every day.
Yeah.
Like, I could do this every single day. Like, literally every single day, I could talk 5-10 hours. Mm-hmm. That's just me. I'm not, I'm a very open person. So it's not, you know, I just don't get the opportunity to do it enough.
Yeah,
so I thank you for the opportunity.
Oh my God, my pleasure and my privilege, and I appreciate you. Just, geez, this has been such a privilege to hear your story and to talk to you and hear, you know, like, normally when we do speaking events, we only have, you know, a smallish amount of time. So I'm so grateful that you were able to give us the extended version so we could hear all the details of what was going on, you know.
I think it's important.
Oh, totally. Tony Robbins says in his documentary, I'm Not Your Guru, he says, I realized at some point doing this work that I started to get addicted to helping people and seeing people transform and seeing people find peace or you know, ending their suffering. And I told, when he said that, I was like, oh my God, I totally agree with you.
If you do become you do get addicted to it, because once you get that first one, I remember my first event, one of my first events that I was able to speak at, you know, after speaking in New York, I came home, like I said, and took everything back, and I was able to speak for the first time, at an event, and it was a group of kids. And just knowing that it had an impact, it's just priceless. It's just something about it that just, it blows you away, and you're never the same anymore.
And when you realize that my darkest experience has helped me, my darkness has changed me and enabled me to meet people where they're at, you know, like, I think if I had had a really cruisy, easy life, that I don't think I would be as good of a therapist. Like, cause you wouldn't know how to meet people. And I think too,
people connect with me because they know and that's why I'm able to, cause I've been through I've been through so many different things in my life. Things that I don't even, it's just like, why am I going through? And then I got to this point of purpose, and it made sense, because it's things in my life that I didn't understand until I'm in, like, Montana of all places or somewhere. And it's a lady who I went through something that when I was like 14 that nobody else knows in the world. And she comes up to me and she goes through the, she's telling me she went through the same thing. She doesn't know me. Like, our lives have never intertwined. We don't have nothing in common.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from so many different backgrounds. Like, we have nothing that should remotely be in common.
Yeah.
And here we are with the exact same thing.
Mm.
And it was like, if I wouldn't have went through that, when I went through it, then I wouldn't have been able to connect with her.
Yeah.
I would have lost her. And because of being able to connect with her and because of what I went through, I was able to connect with her and bring her hope. And she was able to move on from that place that she was in.
Mm-hmm.
And I started realizing, like, okay, these moments are preparing me. This is this is for this.
And it's paying it forward, isn't it? It's you're becoming Kevin Briggs for other people. And then it's just you keep, and then they take your hope and message and keep going. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this. I think this is going to provide a lot of hope and stuff for people. Can you then just like, I think just so much of identity, what you help people with today is hearing themselves in your story or hearing themselves in your pain or hearing themselves in the stories and the feelings that you were sharing. I know there are millions of people who will listen to this and go, that's me.
Yeah.
He knows me. He sees me. He gets me. Hey, where can people find you? What, like, websites, social media? Where are you? What, how do they get in touch with you if they want to learn more or see you?
My, everything is under my name. Then that's because, like I said, identity. I had a problem really identifying who Kevin Berthier is. I've always been so many other different people my whole life, so many different nicknames. You know? Mm-hmm. So now I'm just my Facebook, Kevin Berthier, Twitter at Kevin Berthier. Mm-hmm. LinkedIn is Kevin Berthier. Everything is Kevin Berthier. Like, I can be found on all social media handles. I have a Kevin Berthier suicide survivor advocate and speaker page, business page on Facebook. So yeah, everything is under my name.
Cool.
I have a YouTube. My YouTube is Kevin Berthier.
Awesome.
I have my, you know, the tutorials of me and my son talking. We have fun. And I just show you the, you know, the fun side of my life.
Cool.
You know, just singing at work. Just different things. So just show people the fun side of my life. But everything, you Google my name, everything should pop up.
Okay, cool. Awesome. Thank you so much. I appreciate,
your
vulnerability and your honesty and your authenticity. I appreciate it.
I appreciate that.